Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2019 for the fourth and final stream of this third night. Now, I should say it has got a bit colder since I did the third stream, and I do have a blanket around me just in case anyone's wondering, but it's quite nice, quite cozy. So, all right, here I am with Philosophicat. Now, Philosophicat, I should say first, was supposed to appear on last year's Millennial, 2018, but due to a scheduling conflict, and I think perhaps a mistake on my part, it didn't happen. So I want to first apologise to Philosophicat for that oversight. Since then, she and I have got to know each other fairly well, and you know, not collaborating, but just chatting. And she is a very interesting woman. So welcome, Philosophicat. Welcome to Millennial.
Thank you. And I forgive you about last year, but what I don't forgive you for is mispronouncing my name.
Oh, no. What have I done?
I have to say this because everybody says it wrong. It's Philosophicat.
Oh, okay.
Everybody thinks it's Philosophy Cat. And it's just honestly the dumbest name I could have picked. I wish I'd chosen something else, but it's Philosophicat. Just like if you were saying like a philosophical cat.
Okay.
It was maybe a bit just
Philosophicat. Philosophicat. Okay.
Cat is fine. One syllable. Easy to spell, easy to pronounce.
I think I might just go with cat, just for the sake of avoiding any embarrassing mess-ups later on. So, okay, could you briefly describe yourself and your work to the audience?
Sure. So I have a YouTube channel. Philosophicat is the name of the channel. And
it'd be funny if the channel was called Philosophicat. Right,
then people would have a legitimate reason to be confused. So I've got a channel, and I produce, you know, a video every now and again. I'm not very prolific with it, but at the moment, my big project has been working on a series of Julius Evola's Revolt Against the Modern World, and I'm taking it chapter by chapter, and each chapter gets its own episode. It's not a reading of the book. I do kind of expect that people will read it on their own, but it's more an explanation and expansion of the concepts in each chapter. So we've been trying to do that to, you know, a fairly high quality of work. And in addition to that, I occasionally put out, you know, other types of videos as well that are just kind of like my commentary on whatever I'm interested in. The most recent one I did was called The Path of the Crone, which ended up being more popular than I thought it would be. And I also have my band Uberfolk, and we just released a double album earlier this year. And in fact, the day that I was supposed to come on Millennial last year would have been the day that I think we would have just announced that probably on your show. But so that was a year ago that we released our first song, and we have a YouTube channel for that. We're also on Bandcamp. You can buy the album on CD, baby. That's basically what I do. I think you're muted.
Yes, I was muted.
For once, it wasn't me.
Yeah, there are always interesting technical mess-ups with these streams. Right. So, but one thing you didn't say there was, or maybe this is a misconception on my part, but from what I've seen of your work, a particular concern is men and women. And this is something that you and I have talked about privately. It seems to be an interest of yours, and the fact that relations between men and women are so severely retarded and ruptured by the modern age. And you seem to have a particular interest in that. Would you say that's true?
Yes, and I think part of it might just be because I'm a woman and we tend to be more interested in relational and social things. But I also do think that it is a key issue in the breakdown of society, this division between men and women and the misunderstanding we have of each other, the divisiveness that has been sown amongst us to the point where people will just like have this blanket hatred of the opposite sex. And I think it's really destructive. I think it it makes it hard for us to move forward to a healthier society if we can't work together, because that male and female unit together really is the foundation of everything, because the family is the foundation of everything.
Oh, absolutely. Someone just pointed out, or several people just pointed out, that I've had three women on here in a row tonight. That was not planned. It was simply the way it happened, that people chose those slots. And so it's not a deliberate choice on my part. But on the first and second nights, there were no women on. And now we've got three in a row, just the way it happened. But of course,
to be fair, I'm told I'm an honorary man, although I think if I cry one more time about something silly, my man card gets revoked.
Oh, okay. And someone else
to
is
make
just
anyone
accused,
feel better.
Someone else has just accused me of being a feminist. I think that might have been because of some things that were said in the Robin Riley hangouts.
That's all right. You can start a club. I've been called that too.
Closet feminists in the dissident right.
Indeed.
Okay. All right. So let's talk. I mean, I think there are many problems in society. There are many reasons in which women are the center of those problems, the sort of generator of those from one day to the next. But I would say, and I think you would agree, that it ultimately relies on men to sort it out, as it always does with societal problems. And so the issue is, first of all, how can men get better? But then the issue before that is, what are men supposed to be? So I think that is a crucial question that is lost. And the reason the question is so pertinent is part of the disruption has been to erase the archetypes of male and female and masculine and feminine, and part of the way that's been done is to pretend that there is no male and female. There is no man, there is no woman. At the cultural level, and now even at the genetic hormonal level. So, I mean, I think we can proceed with the premise that there is such a thing as a man, there is such a thing as a woman. But that's not enough. It can't just be a biological fact. There also has to be psychology, spirituality involved in it as well. Constructs that help those biological organisms to function. So please go ahead and tell me, from your point of view, what is a man, apart from obviously a biologically male creature?
All right. It's the Jesse Lee Peterson question.
Amazing.
That's amazing. I won't call you a beta male, but
thank you. At least not until the end of the stream.
Well, maybe then we'll see. So, what is a man? It's a complex question that really needs a simple answer. And my answer to that, which you might have picked up because I know you've recently watched my video, Traditional Man's Path to Heroism, I would say that man is the embodiment of the active force. He is the lightning rod. And I think to discuss that further, we almost need to kind of discuss what a man's role is. So what does it mean to be the embodiment of that active force? And we can look at man as, for example, take the word virtue, for example. The root word of virtue comes from vir in Latin, or vir, if you want to go with the classical pronunciation, which means man. His role is to embody virtue. And if a man doesn't have any virtue, then what is he? He's just an animal. He's a beast. His lower animalistic energies will come to dominate him. Whereas a man who is imbued with virtue, his whole being, his mind, body, and soul are all dedicated to virtue, then he can be more of an expression of godliness. And it's not just really any virtue or principle. It needs to be embodied in a vital way. And what that means is that it needs to be embodied in a way that life can generate around it. It's one thing to embody a principle in a way that kind of cancels you out, anything that's self-destructive. It's not vital in the sense that it's self-terminating. Life can't grow up around it. And one example of that would be you know, the very hardcore MGTOW types who have this principle that they believe in very strongly, but it's a principle that does not beget life. It can only bring death. So the ultimate acid test for a qualifying idea is whether or not the man's philosophy or virtue or principle that he's orienting his life around is whether or not it's life affirming. It needs to be able to either generate life or help life flourish.
Right. Sorry, I didn't realize you were about to stop.
I can keep going if you want, but I started to feel like I was monologuing a bit, and I thought you might want to, if you want to interject it.
No, that's fine. I mean, one thought that does occur is that I do think that MGTOW, I mean, people have said this a lot, that that there is a, MGTOW is a sort of, it's not a productive philosophy. It's something that is a coping strategy for men in a certain situation. Hold on, I'm just going to get rid of a particularly stupid commenter. it's a coping strategy, but it's also very it's counterproductive. I mean, obviously, for each individual guy who goes into it, it might be useful, but at a societal level, it's suicidal. And in that sense, it's a mirror image of hardcore feminism.
Yes, and I would say that, you know, there is validity for the MGTOW thing as a certain phase in life, although I don't think it should come with a hatred of women. You can certainly hate the characteristics of modern women. There's a lot to dislike about that. But I'm more referring to the MGTOWs that, you know, they can't stop talking or thinking about women. Their whole psyche is oriented around how much they hate women, and they're watching porn.
And that's a massive, it's a massive giveaway, the fact that they constantly talk about women. Yes. I mean, I'm sorry, it's like armchair psychologizing here, but it's pretty obvious.
You're not really going your own way at that point, because your life is still centered around women. And I do think it would actually be a good thing for men to have a phase where they don't think about women and they aren't orienting their whole psyche around them. You know, to go away, focus on your career, focus on doing deep work on yourself, build yourself up. And when you're ready to have children and a family, then you can kind of come back to the fold and find yourself a good woman. And this is, I would say, you know, in terms of it being like this self-terminating point of view, that's true of anything that's black-pilled. And, you know, we see a lot of black pills in the movement, and, you know, there's no life there. There's no hope. They attract a lot of angry and self-destructive people. And, you know, they may even be right about their points of view, but no life can rally around it. And you cannot build a movement out of negativity. You could attract a lot of attention and generate a lot of energy around it, but it's ultimately still self-terminating. And, you know, that in itself is not attractive to women who want to have children, who are naturally very future-focused.
It's also not attractive to men who want, who don't want to be chronically depressed all the time. And, you know, even I don't want to be chronically depressed all the time. So I'm guessing that most men are even more so. You know, there are different reasons to get involved in a dissident movement, and some of those reasons are just, you know, you've perceived that the world is in a bad way. Other reasons are more personal, and that's not necessarily bad, but it does mean that you bring baggage to the movement, and, you know, that a lot of people are not self-aware. They're not aware of that. They don't quite realize the danger here. You know, that you end up just injecting negativity into that movement. And I think that this is something you and I have talked about privately, and I've talked about it before publicly, that a lot of the dissident right is negative. And I don't think, I think this is a growing pain, but it's also not something that's going to just take care of itself. It is something we need to think about consciously. Yes, the world is messed up, but you can't just endlessly repeat that and sort of meditate on it. There has to be, and your attitude has to be a healthy one. It can't just be, oh God, everything's lost, everything's messed up, and that's the end of the matter. There has to be defiance, I think.
Exactly. And as I said, I mean, some of these black pills might even be valid points of view, but they're valid points of view that lead you off a cliff. And there certainly is a cliff coming up. But if it's not proposing any solutions, you're essentially just wallowing in your own filth. And once you've identified that the modern world is a complete dumpster fire, what are you going to do? Just keep telling everybody about it? You know, I think a lot of people think that that is what they should do. But expressing that kind of hopelessness is the equivalent of, it's like recognizing that your house is on fire and there are people trapped inside who don't know it's burning. At that point, it's appropriate to run around and scream fire. It's important to get them out. But once everyone already knows there's a fire, if you're still just running around screaming fire and not working out how to escape the burning house, you're doing the wrong thing, to put it mildly. You should only exert the amount of energy towards a stage of a problem that is required in order to get to the next stage. And there's this collective awareness in the movement and certain ideas that are, you know, maybe a little passe to keep pointing out, like the silliness of SJWs or crime statistics or whatever. There are normies who still need to learn those things, but anyone who's been in this for a while and within our own circles, we need to move on to a different phase of action. We need to shift our energy to addressing it and overcoming it. And if you can't overcome the despair in order to design an exit strategy or develop a healthy response, then the undertow will just pull you down with it. So you need to keep your eyes on where you want to be going, not looking at the wall you don't want to hit. And if you focus on the negativity, of course, it will pull you in with it. And your own life just ends up becoming another tragedy, just another sad story of the modern world eating up the potential of what you could have been.
Oh, absolutely. I see this a lot. I see this endless rumination on facts that, like I talked about 5 years ago, nearly 6 years ago, and other people have been talking about for even longer. And I don't like it because there has to be progress, and progress in the good sense of the word, obviously. And I think that some of us, like you and I, have been in this movement for some time. You've been in it for longer than I have. I think that it's up to us, unfortunately, because some of us are, you know, often tired and weary with it all, but it does fall to us to try to find more productive, constructive ways forward. Partly yeah. Because we know the danger so well. We've seen so many people fall to unhelpful ways of thinking.
Absolutely. And I think part of the problem is that people feel stuck and they don't know what to do. So they just kind of keep spinning their wheels. They keep complaining about the same things because, of course, the problem is still there to be complained about. But in terms of finding a solution, you know, there's not a lot of guidance for them. It's very unfortunate that in the movement, we do not have kind of an older generation guiding the younger people because there's such a high turnover of people in the movement. A lot of people, you know, I would say most people burn out within about 5 years. And as a result, there are a lot of good people who would have had wisdom to share with the younger people coming in who are no longer around to do that. And by the same token, we have a lot, like a lot of the movement leaders just tend to be whoever has been able to grab the mic and speak the loudest. In many cases, these are young people who are very excited about their new ideas or new to them, but they don't have the life experience, they don't have the wisdom, they don't have the leadership skills, and, you know, a lot of them will crash and burn, or they get tired of it and they quit, they lose interest or whatever, because there's nobody around to teach them how to stay in this in a healthy way where it doesn't really start to affect your psyche. It's difficult to be around so many negative and black-pilled people all the time and not become that way yourself. And eventually just, you know, as you said, nobody wants to be depressed all the time. And I know from my own experience, a number of people, you know, who have kind of left the movement just because they were sick of being depressed all the time and nothing was going anywhere. And, you know, to those people, my advice always was that if you feel you need to quit, then that's what you should do. Leaving the movement doesn't mean you need to stop caring about your people. It doesn't mean you need to stop caring about these issues. It just means that you're removing yourself from what you feel is a toxic environment and limiting your exposure to that. And I think that is very important for people to understand, is that you can always, the care you have for your people need not wane just because you don't want to be involved in a kind of an online atmosphere that's very blackpilling.
Yeah, I mean, I think one way to approach it is not to leave. I mean, yes, I for what it's worth, I think I did burn out after 5 years. But that's not quite relevant. I think one way of dealing with it is, as you say, it's a toxic environment. But one way to do this is try to create your own oasis in that that is not toxic. And this is why, for example, I ban people all the time from my YouTube channel every day, especially now with these streams happening. And I don't like doing it, but I have to do it because otherwise my channel will just be one more toxic place in this movement where people say nasty, unconstructive things to each other, defeatist and venomous things to each other. I don't want that. And I don't want the low brow nature of it either. So I have to do that. And I think that really that should be the notion all throughout the movement. You know, if people are being unpleasant, nasty, vindictive, and defeatist, they're not helping. They're creating a bad atmosphere.
Exactly. And I mean, I remember saying to you privately that I fully supported your decision if you would ever want to take a step back for your own mental health. And I maintain that to this day for anybody who comes asking for my advice on what they should do in that regard. And, you know, it's there's nothing wrong with cutting toxic people out of your life, especially online. These are people you don't even know and they don't matter. I certainly used to take the tack of like, oh, well, you know, I support free speech, so I'm not going to ban anybody. But honestly, I just, I don't have the time and energy to deal with people who just want to be combative. And it does attract a lot of angry people who have nothing better to do with their time, unfortunately. But, you know, I think there is the problem with a lot of people in the movement being depressed and nihilistic. And it does, you know, even though I don't want to engage with them, I do feel sorry for them. And I can understand where they're coming from, what the pain that drives them to behave that way and the frustration they must be feeling. And of course, you know, when you feel that way all the time, the tendency is just to lash out at whoever's closest. And in some ways, the right has bought into the outrage culture just as much as the left have. It's just expressed in a different way. But it's full of people who are, you know, kind of just looking for the next reason to be angry. They were already angry, but it's just they need a new outlet to express it.
Sometimes I get a question, someone will ask me, what do you think about X thing? And I know what they want me to say is, I disapprove of it like you do. Like they want me to agree that it's bad. And that's all they want. It might be a bad thing, it might not be, but either way, I note this, this desire to endlessly disapprove of things. And I think it's bad. It's self-ghettoizing, but it's also just depressing for the person who's doing it.
Yes, there's a lot of authoritarianism in the movement. And I think part of that is because people are lacking the self-sufficiency to be leaders in their own lives. And they require that kind of conformist orthodox thinking as a false support. And, you know, I do think we need to be a more heterodox movement because many of us came to these ideas through heterodox thinking. However, there are a lot of people who do want to gatekeep opinions and force conformity. And this is not a way to build a viable movement. We should be continually offering olive branches to those who are our opponents. We can firmly believe that we are right, but to hate a person who has been bathed in the wrong beliefs their whole life does not help our cause at all. What helps is stating our views plainly and clearly, but always with a handout that says, come and join us, not by drawing lines in the sand. Having that type of an openness is far more important. And, you know, too many people have been turned off by this because of, you know, the lunatic fringe and the people who haven't done deep work on themselves. For us to have a chance at all, you know, we're going to need to be a little bit more open and accepting and more forgiving.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree with that. So to get back to what we were saying earlier, the question of what is a man and what is he for? What is his role in the world? Regardless, I mean, and by the way, so I can just imagine some Mignos saying, who are you to say what a man is for? But this is a question that's intrinsic to reality, to the animal that we are. So go ahead. please.
Well, you know, that is a valid objection that people might have is, you know, what business does a woman have telling a man what he should be?
No, I meant the direct fact at me, not at you. Because I this is something I see with MGTOWs is that a certain, and again, I don't want to go on about, I don't want to attack MGTOWs too much, but it's something I see, a certain nihilism that almost that as if it comes from the libertarian background where they're almost saying that nothing is set in stone here. Any man is whatever he wants to be. There's it's almost like they want nothingness. Anyway, sorry, go on.
There is a nihilistic streak in the movement. I've made a whole 4-part series of videos on this subject on my channel. That's maybe a bit of a digression from the topic. But in terms of like who is qualified to talk about what a man is, well, I think it's an ongoing conversation and one that everybody has the right to participate in, man or woman. You know, I can't speak for you, but for my part, I have read a lot of books by men who discuss this subject. And, you know, I do feel that women can offer a reflection to men in a way. We can... It's not even just a case of women telling men what they want from them. It's not a case of women making a wish list and being like, my perfect man needs to have this, 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 and this. Although there are certainly some women who do that, but it is valuable for a man to know what women need from him. Because even though he does not orientate his life around woman the same way woman orients hers around a man, they still do need to work together as a team. He does not exist in a vacuum, and not just in a team with, you know, his partner, but I mean, we exist in a society. It's valuable to know what are the different types of men. What does it mean to be a man? What are valid expressions of masculinity? What are not valid expressions? So I think anybody should be welcome to participate in that conversation.
I think it's a mistake for men to say things like a woman has no place telling a man how to be a man. I mean, I understand the sentiment, but I think it's just a bit naive and or just angry. It comes from a place of anger. The fact is, it is often the case that a guy will be shaken into being what he should be by a woman saying, look, I need you to fucking man up, basically. I mean, that happens. That is known to happen. You know, I'm not being a feminist by saying that.
Well, for a lot of men, they are motivated by women. I actually don't think that that's a particularly healthy expression of masculinity, because that in itself is a somewhat feminine way of being, because it's, you know, as I spoke about in my traditional path to women's heroism or whatever it's called, you know, women orient themselves around service to another. They take their guidance in life based off of the man who is the one they've chosen to serve, whether that's their husband, their son, their father, or even God. Men don't orient in the same way. And that's because men are that active principle, whereas women are a passive force. So men do need to be their own guiding light to some degree. And if you are continually chasing after women, that's a very lunar type of behavior. It's very feminine in its nature. And you could be a very like so-called manly man. You know, you could be one of the, what do they call, alpha Chad or whatever they're called. But you could still be behaving in like this lunar way.
Well, this is something that you spoke about in the two videos that I watched earlier, where the man is a solar, a producer, a generator of light, energy, direction, and the woman as a reflector of it. And this is what I was going to get onto earlier. When, of course, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, women want, women. Your average woman wants a man that she can follow and be led by and support and believe in. And you could say it comes from believing in her father and being led by him. You know, it's the same sort of thing. But that does not mean that she can't also influenced him. I mean, I think that this is just an inevitable thing. It's going to happen in any healthy partnership. There is going to be some level of trust, and the man is going to be able to be guided to some extent by the woman, sometimes reminding him, hey, you're the guy here. You're supposed to be the one providing direction. Now, I'm not saying that this is ideal. I'm just saying it sometimes happens. So for guys to automatically dismiss what women have to say, I just think is, frankly, overly defensive.
I think it is defensive. And, you know, part of the reason for that is woman presents the biggest challenge to a man's masculinity. If there is one thing that will challenge a man to rise to his greatest heights, it is usually a woman. And that is even the case when a man is not necessarily orienting his life around a woman, but women have long been inspirational forces for men. Kind of, in many cases, the wind beneath their wings. It's not even a case of like he needs to like listen to what she says or anything, but in many cases, just because she brings that relational aspect to their partnership, and she can inspire. For example, if you take one of the archetypes I spoke about in the women's video is Aphrodite, and she kind of has this reputation as the Greek goddess. Her story, you know, she's a little bit maybe promiscuous in her story, but as an archetype of absolute woman, we're not necessarily talking about her story in the Greek mythology. And I do say that I think of her more as an amalgamation of a number of these types of goddesses, but she's more like the muse to a man. And so you might have a man who's, you know, innovative or some kind of a genius or whatever. And because man is, you know, he's solar and his ideas are in the sky, it's a very airy quality to his thinking. He might have these great ideas, but no practicality to them. And so Aphrodite, or even Demeter in some cases, whoever his woman is, can be a grounding force for him. Pull out those ideas back down to earth and say, but do they work? Have you thought about this? How's this going to impact our family? What if you did this? And she can kind of apply a more practical notion to his ideas to bring them to life in the material world. Because man's thinking, especially for those who are very high IQ and have a tendency to maybe get lost in their own heads a lot, you know, a lot of times they don't think about those practical aspects needed to make their ideas a reality. So in that way, a woman can be very helpful to a man.
Of course, it's also the inverse is also true, where a man can make a woman more realistic. So this is one of these things that's actually very nuanced. Women are fickle and often very practical, surprisingly practical. For creatures that are supposed to be very emotional and, you know, dreamy or whatever, the woman is often the realist. But also, there are cases where the woman is the one getting carried away, and it's the man's job to introduce practicality to that situation.
Yes, and I spoke a little bit about this concept in a video called The Path of the Crone, which is a video for women who, you know, may not get married or have children, or whose children have left home and are in their later years of their life. Maybe their husband's passed away. And the whole concept of, you know, for a woman developing herself into a crone is to actually embody some of that masculine energy. And it goes into kind of Carl Jung's idea of the anima and the animus. We each of us have this opposite sex archetype within ourselves. And so for a man, he's got his inner anima, his inner woman, and the female has her inner man or animus. And as we develop ourselves, we should be able to get in touch with that and integrate that into our personalities. So the older you get, the more comfortable you should be with those kind of opposite sex qualities within yourself, because, and this is not to suggest that I believe gender is anything other than binary. Obviously, I only believe in two genders, but we all have qualities within us that, you know, might be in a bit of a gray area as to whether it's really masculine or feminine. I mean, you know, for myself, the videos I make on YouTube are, I really tap into a lot of my masculine thinking, and that's a quality that I've really tried to develop in myself. And I would say even in my younger years, probably at the expense of my feminine self. And as I've gotten older, managed to integrate those in a more healthy way and in a more beneficial way so that my thinking is more holistic now. As opposed to just being like coldly rational, like a man is, you know, and bringing some feeling aspect into it and intuition into it as well.
Somebody is accusing you of being a feminist by talking about inner women and stuff like that.
Well, they can accuse me of being a feminist, but then I guess Carl Jung was also a feminist, and so was a number of other philosophers and traditional thinkers. This is a concept that goes back to antiquity. So this is not a new idea at all. This is not something I came up with on my own.
All right. I do think that, again, this I'm annoyed by the simplistic thinking that some people are drawn to and introduced to the chat. I mean, I'm sorry to be patronizing, but really, you know, it's kind of annoying. Because there is truth to this. I mean, men tend to be the romantics, the creative ones, that, as someone said, the ones who write love songs and so forth. And I think that does take a certain, what you might call feminine sensitivity.
I would say a man who does that probably has a fairly well-developed anima and a healthy relationship with his anima.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's not that these facets are innately unhealthy. For a man to have feminine aspects of his personality, what is important is the ways in which he handles them and uses them and controls them.
Exactly. I can understand the reaction against the idea, and especially from people who maybe haven't read as much or thought as much about this topic as, you know, people like you and I have, especially in the modern world where you do see a lot of like overly feminized men, you know, the soy boys. That is not a healthy expression at all. That is so against the natural order. I don't support that at all. I would never encourage a man towards that. That is a man who maybe has developed, it's what we would call anima possession. He is so identified with his anima that it has overcome him. He has lost his masculinity. And, you know, you could even say the same thing about perhaps transsexuals or homosexuals to some extent. And it's just
more
another...
Though, it's more pertinent to talk about the supposedly straight guy who is like this, the soy boy.
Exactly. And... there are men like that. It's true. And it's, I can understand a man looking at a soy boy man and being like, oh, I don't want to be like that. He's too feminine. And so they swing the other way to overcompensate. And then all of a sudden they're all about, you know, talking about how they're an alpha male and they go to the gym and they eat all this steak. And it's like, they're just almost making themselves into a caricature of masculinity, and they think that by taking on all these external affectations, that that's what it means to be a man. And to that, I would say, no, that's not what it means to be a man. In fact, the very reactivity of that kind of thinking is actually somewhat feminine. And so when they swing to the opposite side of the pendulum, where you have the soy boys who are anima possessed, on the other end of the extreme end of the spectrum, you have men who have suppressed their anima so far into their shadow self, it actually controls them from their subconscious without them realizing it.
And this is absolutely, you see, what you just said sounds very complicated, but it's so prevalent. People, and this is why I say again and again that people should try to know themselves. First, know thyself and self-reflect. I've said it so many times in the channel. I wish people would be more self-reflective, because if you're not, then I've seen it before I knew any of this terminology. I saw this I just witnessed it in other people, where you would see them being controlled by something that they had kidded themselves they no longer had. Like, oh, I've defeated that part of myself. No, it's there and it's controlling you. It's, you just, but because you think it's not there, it is able to control you.
Yes, and this is another Jungian concept, the shadow self. It is that that unknown part of ourself. It's where we put all the parts of ourselves that we don't want to admit are part of us. So, you know, for example, if, you know, we all have narratives about ourselves. So if I have a narrative that is, one of them might be, I'm Kat and I'm a good person. Everything about me that suggests I'm not a good person, I would perhaps repress into my shadow. So the fact that I callously walked by a homeless person without giving them money, well, if that doesn't fit with my narrative of what a good person would do, and I'm committed to this narrative, I'm going to press that down into my shadow self. That's not me, you know. And you see this come out in people many times in hypocrisy or in projection, for example. You know, we all know somebody who has accused us of doing something that they themselves do all the time while they swear up and down that they have never done it.
Yes.
And that is the person's shadow talking. And Jung said it takes a lot of moral courage to look at your shadow, and therefore not many people will do it successfully.
I also think it manifests in overcompensation, which is very obvious, I don't think I need to give examples of that. But yeah, I think this is extremely important. I mean, you could almost do a video just on this. I think it's so relevant and so pertinent.
I almost did a video series on it, and I had just gotten a new computer at the time. I typed up a bunch of notes, and my brand new computer crashed. It had not been backed up, and those files were unrecoverable. And after that, I just kind of lost my mojo for it, and I haven't gone back to it. I have instead kind of, as I said, I incorporated some of those concepts into my video on the Path of the Crone, which despite it being aimed at women, I do think men might enjoy watching it. I did get a lot of positive comments from men that I wasn't expecting, saying that they found it interesting and pertinent to them as well. But just in regards to, you know, these dysfunctional men, this, we have a lot of modern men are very degraded, very far fallen away from the archetype of absolute man. And I think, you know, to some extent, we have to extend some sympathy and understanding because we are all degraded forms of our archetype.
Yes.
None of us has emerged unscathed from modernity. Even those of us who seem to be doing better than others, you know, we still have a lot of work to do. All of us need to. But, you know, the question that I get a lot on my videos has been, you know, what has caused this to happen? And a lot of men tend to blame women, but you have to remember that women are reflective. They're lunar. We reflect what men do. And so we have to consider that men degraded first. And what caused this is the next question. So if we look at history from the perspective of a cyclical pattern, we have the emergence of, you know, religious prophets, these points of light throughout centuries of suffering. And these points of light are like metaphysical events that create an initial activation of the spiritual circuits in humanity, and kind of a renaissance of spiritual living can come from that. However, all things eventually degrade. Entropy is a principle of the universe. And the further away we get from that original event, then everything naturally degrades. And so man's lower nature takes over. There is essentially a spiritual devolution. If you're born into an era of degeneracy, you know, what hope do you have? You might grow up feeling quite passive because the only thing that life has shown you is that if you try to resist degeneracy, you'll only get hurt yourself. And this is why no one wants to speak truth to power anymore. No one wants to stand up for what's right if it's unpopular. And they can't resist the societal pressure to conform. So men become feminine with this passivity that they have been taught from birth. They've been conditioned to this. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if someday in the future we find out, you know, neuroscience discovers that this has actually fundamentally rewired the brains of men growing up in an environment like this. So, you know, as I said, it doesn't matter who you are. We're all affected by this modern age. We're all imperfect versions of ourselves. And no matter how much you've mastered yourself, you've still been affected by growing up in a world full of unhealthy people, not being supported in life to grow in a healthy way. And we have all wasted years or even decades of our lives trying to overcome modernity. So these comments apply to us all. And yes, we are building our movement, for lack of a better term, out of people from this modern age. And it bears all the signs of modern people. And this is what our primary task is. Evola said that it's our job is not to come up with, you know, new fancy philosophies or economic systems. There's no answers in legislation that will fix the problem. The only hope is going through the arduous process of building a new man. It's like the difference between a man who puts padding in his jacket and one who's spent years training in the gym. And if we put them to the test, you know, we'll see who's actually done the real work. And the guy who's been in the gym, he hasn't just developed his muscles. He's also developed discipline through his commitment to weightlifting. And he's changed his ontological nature through that discipline, especially if he's also done it by making an overall commitment to his health. But if you're living in an environment where all the signs are pointing, you know, to where you need to go, but then you get there and you find out that they were actually pointing the wrong way, you don't discover it until you actually end up in the wrong place. You're like, oh, huh, well, the signs said I should go here, but this isn't where I meant to go. If you live in a society where all the maps are wrong, you waste a lot of time and energy before you discover you have to turn back or find your own way. So yeah, we're building a movement out of broken people, but that should fuel our energy to overcome the situation. And I think it should make you want to reclaim what was robbed from you. You know, don't forget what was taken from you. We each live a personal example of this in our lives, but once you realize this in a deep and complete way, don't approach it as a novelty or entertainment. You know, view this as life itself, because this is really a spiritual test. What we need to overcome is no different than what a man had to overcome 5,000 years ago. And that's his own lower energies that make him want to be more of a hedonistic animal. This is what we all have to face. How to channel our energies into something higher, make an art of living, be devoted to a principle that is about living in a noble way, you know, being Arya, which means noble, striving for excellence in everything that you do.
Yeah. I think that this gets to the question that I began with, which is, what is a man? And in your videos, you use the traditional man's path to heroism. You said that a man should embody or aspire to a principle, and that is the light that he generates into the world, which is mm-hmm. reflected by a woman. See, the way I would have approached this, the way I would say this, is that a man is a creature that interacts with the world and tries to change the world in some sense, even if it's in a quite mundane way. Ultimately, a guy is a creature that changes the world, that interacts with it. And I think that that is basically, and as I say, that can be from a very mundane way to something very grand and massive. Like a leader and so forth. And really the function of a woman is to be that support to that guy. Whether it's the wife of the mechanic at a local garage, or it's the wife of a president, whatever. So I think those are the two things that I would start with. And I don't know, do you have anything to say about that?
About the archetypes of a man or a woman's role in relation to them?
Let's start with the archetypes of a man.
Well, the two I outline are the ascetic and the warrior. There are, of course, many other archetypes, but these are the two that Evola outlines as being heroic paths. And by heroic paths, that means one that will lead a man to the transcendent. The ascetic is the path of contemplation. The warrior is the path of action. And in some cases, they are kind of two sides of the same coin, because they almost need to develop the same set of skills, but it's a slightly different expression depending on whether it's the ascetic or the warrior path. You still need to develop discipline of both your mind and your body for both of those.
Yes. Sorry, I've had to block another few people. It's amazing. I'm going to sound like a bit of a feminist here, but it is amazing how many men are unsettled by you and what you're saying. And
it's, yes,
you know, I'm rather disappointed. I don't recognize most of the names, so they might well be trolls who are not on my channel usually, and are just here because of you.
Well, I guess I would say to anybody who is feeling a bit triggered by anything I say, that's a very good opportunity for some self-exploration and reflection. What is it in you that is causing you to feel so emotional about it? Why can you not be more detached from what you hear somebody say?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a guy saying that he never swore. Why was he blocked? You didn't need to swear. You were saying things that were just unhelpful and unconstructive. And I think that we're coming from a bad place. So, I mean, I'm sorry to be a cliche here, but I think you need to self-reflect. So, all right, let's get back to, as I was saying earlier, when I said that a man's place is to change the world, someone said most men can't, that's beyond most men. What I meant by that statement is that obviously most men are not going to change the world at a grand level, but just it's something as simple as putting up a shelf. Like, that wall does not have a shelf on it. I'm going to change it so that it now does. That's a man interacting with his environs and changing them, making them more what he wants. So, and serving, therefore serving some higher purpose than just, you know, the molecules around him. So that's what I mean when I say changing the world. Someone's accused me of being politically correct. Get a fucking life. So, yes, please take that away.
Sorry, where did we leave off? That was a bit of a tangent.
Well, we're talking about a man's place being as a sort of agent of change of some kind or other, and a woman's place to support him in that.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I agree with what you're saying, that it doesn't have to be like world changing. It is really just more about interacting with the world and bringing your vision to life in an imminent way. And you can do that in very small ways. Of course, it's going to be a small number of men who do world changing things. But at the same time, you can change your own world within your life. I think, you know, we do see a lot this kind of tendency to be nihilistic because, you know, the problems of the modern world seem so big. You know, it's a tremendous challenge to change anything, even in our local communities. Like, more and more, we just kind of feel powerless to fix anything. All of these problems just seem beyond one person. The solution to that is to tend a tiny garden. And I don't mean a literal garden, although that can be very enjoyable. And in case men didn't know this, working with tools apparently raises your testosterone. So go chop some wood. But keep your sphere of influence small and keep your focus on creating a sanctuary for yourself within the modern world. And this is one of the reasons why I like Evola's Revolt Against the Modern World book so much that I'm willing to commit like 2 or 3 years of my time to make this 40 episode series. Because I ultimately agree with the premise that, you know, revolting against the modern world isn't about complaining and trying to look for political solutions, but it's about, you know, going within and building yourself up from the inside, because no matter how many freedoms they take from us, no matter if we're deplatformed or thrown in a gulag, nothing they do can touch what's in here unless you allow it. And so Evola's solution is, Revolt is a very spiritual book, which I think a lot of people have a misconception that it's going to be, you know, very polemical. And they start reading it and they're like, it's not anything like what they expected. Because he does go a lot into like very spiritual, metaphysical topics. And his solution is, you know, to build a new man, build a sanctuary within yourself. It's the same thing when people talk about like riding the tiger. A number of people who will say, oh, we need to ride the tiger, don't actually understand what is meant by that. They just know the title of the book. You know, riding the tiger isn't about interacting with modernity so much as building up a sanctuary within yourself so that you can ride out the Kali Yuga and emerge unscathed because you are so mentally and spiritually strong.
Yeah. Well, this is about Stoicism, isn't it?
Stoicism is a particular school of philosophy. There are a number of ways that a person could probably achieve this. Any legitimate spiritual path and doing really deep work on yourself. I think it's really, I tend to be very non-sectarian in that regard. And I think that, you know, we should aim for a number of different spiritual expressions for people to best find their own way, their own spiritual journey, what really resonates with them. I would rather see somebody deeply committed to a spiritual path that I disagree with, that is genuinely beneficial for them and genuinely helps them build up that internal strength, than I would to see somebody half-heartedly pursue something they didn't really believe in just because I agreed with it.
Yes. I mean, would you say it's something that's, in this sense, archetypes are not so helpful?
Well, archetypes are helpful in the sense that they give us something to orient towards. So one of the things that I explain in, it's either the first or second episode of my Revolt series, if people want a more in-depth explanation of it, this idea of time and space where we have the metaphysical world, which, you know, you can kind of think of it like Platonic forms. They're archetypes. And these archetypes are kind of the heavenly molds from which the material world is cast. Now, in the metaphysical world, they don't have the limitations of time and space. Everything just exists. You know, it doesn't have limitations of matter. It doesn't exist within linear time the way we experience it. But once it's reflected into the material world, those limitations create imperfect reflections of these archetypes. So it's not realistic or possible to achieve perfection of an archetype in a material body. It's just not going to happen. However, that doesn't mean we can't still orient towards it and use it as a guiding compass and say, well, this is perfection and I want to get as close to that as I can in this lifetime. The fact that you won't reach it is, it doesn't matter. It's almost kind of like the journey is more important than the destination.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about an ideal is never going to be reached, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be aspired to.
Exactly. I agree.
Yeah. Sorry. I thought you'd finished speaking and I had just inhaled from this vaping thing.
That's okay.
I was caught off guard there.
Beta.
Well, my apologies for vaping. Sorry. In a beta fashion.
I held off for 57 minutes.
So final, we can do a few super chats. If there are any super chats for Philosophicat, yes. Now would be the time to post them. But in the meantime, there were a few comments that I think would be interesting to pick up on, but basically, the main one was that I wanted to bring to your attention. Okay, here's one. Here's one. Men need to realize that women are like children, mentally speaking. What would you say to that, first of all?
I think it's more nuanced than that. There is perhaps an element of truth to that in the sense that men need to understand that their role is to guide women because they are the active force. They are the one with the vision. So in that sense, yes. However, women are just as intellectually capable as a man. I mean, this idea that men are somehow smarter is not true. The average IQ for men and women still falls within the same range. You just have more men, obviously, at the extremes. But it is true that...
Well, it's not just a matter of intelligence, though. It's the nature.
Yes. And I think part of this misunderstanding comes from the fact that we live in an age where rationalism, logic, empiricism, and very male ways of knowing are considered not just the gold standard, but like the only ways of knowing. And it really discounts feminine ways of knowing, which are more relational and intuitive. So women think very differently than men do. However, women can develop the masculine way of knowing if they work at it. And for some women, it might come more naturally than for others. It comes very naturally to me, but I have many of my girlfriends who really struggle with it. And part of what a man needs to do for a woman is to help her develop that, much in the way that she needs to help him develop his more feeling side.
To be less autistic.
To put it bluntly. And together they work together to help each other grow into complete and integrated, well-adjusted people. And this is where the archetype of the crone and the sage come into play. So I don't entirely disagree with the idea behind that statement. I disagree maybe with the way that it's worded, but there's some truth to it.
I think there is a lot of truth to it, I have to say. But again, even as I say those words, my mind immediately says, but hold on a minute, a lot of men are like boys, mentally speaking.
You know, yes, they are.
So it's, and I'm not just trying to be, I'm trying to be comprehensive and truthful here, by the way, just in case anyone's saying that I'm being a simp. It's true. I mean, like so many people I know, it's the guy who's fucking up.
Is it not the case that with those men who are themselves like children, they have an underdeveloped masculine principle? They are in some ways too feminized.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
When we say that somebody is there, that their thinking is like a child, what we're really saying is that their thinking is feminine, which, you know, in this day and age where, you know, science is the god of everything, that kind of thinking is looked down upon. And of course, this is not in any way to suggest that, and I'm sure I'm not looking at the comments, but I'm sure there are people who will bring this up, you know, yes, female emotionality can cause problems. And this is why it needs to be grounded by rationality, whether that comes from an external source like her husband, or whether it is something she develops internally. But that is the nature of women, is to be somewhat reactive in that way. Before they can even intellectually walk themselves through something, that reactivity, that emotionality comes through first. But it doesn't mean women are not capable of thinking rationally.
Oh, women are capable of thinking very rationally. That's something that can be very surprising to, has been surprising to me, and I think to a lot of guys, when a woman is far more coldly logical than you are, the guy, are being. And it can be quite astonishing, you know, how clearly a woman can see something. I don't need to go into examples, but I think this is something that men have either... will either be open to acknowledging or not.
Well, the flip side of that is oftentimes I do find that men who talk a lot about, oh, women are so emotional, they can't think logically, are some of the most emotional men I have ever encountered. And they will swear up and down that they're not. Again, this is their shadow side. You know, they've repressed that into their shadow and it's controlling them from their subconscious. It's like everybody has known somebody who has shouted, oh, I'm not angry, while they're clearly very angry. It's kind of like that. So you have men who are in complete denial about how emotional they are. And so they are actually projecting that onto women.
Yes. Yes. That is definitely something that I've seen. Actually, I know I'm agreeing with so many of your criticisms of men that I'm in danger of. I know how this is going to... I don't want to seem like I'm just agreeing for the sake of it. It's just that recognize a lot of truth in what you're saying.
Well, I'm not even criticizing men so much as they might think. I do actually have a lot of sympathy for men. I like men very much. I respect men. But there are problems within modern people, both men and women alike, that need to be addressed. They need to be discussed and brought into the open. And I would hope that anyone who's feeling criticized just uses it as an opportunity to self-reflect. I could say just as many things about women.
Mm.
But what it all comes down to is not whether or not it's a man or a woman. It's the fact that they're just broken modern people.
Mm.
And I'm not exempt from that. I'm not sitting up here on my high horse being like, oh, I'm better than you. I've got it all figured out. That's not the case at all. I've got plenty to work on in my own life. And in some ways, it is through doing that that I have come to identify these things.
Mm, mm. I think it might be worth talking more about. Someone says, well, what are your criticisms of women then? And I think that's a legitimate question, because I would like to be this, to be more comprehensive, to be more fair.
Certainly. Well, probably the biggest, you know, the biggest complaint that I have heard people raise about women is that they're just not very feminine anymore. And that is true of modern women. We have like a crisis of femininity where, you know, the original source event, we may be men or something, but the fact is women still have agency and we need to be responsible for ourselves and the choices we make in life. And in many cases, we have women who have been raised to believe that they are wonderful just because they are women. And, you know, for example, you can see this in just about every movie that comes out with a female heroine. She's wonderful because she's a woman. She didn't have to work hard for anything. And
yeah, the new Star Wars thing is like that.
I haven't seen it because I heard it was terrible, but that's an example. Yeah. And it's such a perversion of femininity. I'm starting to lose my powers of speech here. Women have been taught that these are the role models they should aspire to. And what it actually is not being a woman. It's pretending to be a man, but without any of the challenges men have to go through. And, you know, both sexes have their hard points in life. I don't think it's objectively better to be one sex or the other. There's difficult things about both. But for women to think that they can just go out and be a man, act like a man and be successful, but still keep all the privileges of femininity, has generated a lot of spoiled, entitled princesses. And I can understand why men would be disgusted with women like that, because I'm disgusted with women like that. I don't want to be friends with women like that. I won't have them in my social circles at all. Like, without exception, if there's a woman around me who behaves like that, she's out of my life. I won't put up with it.
I think the Star Wars thing is a good one to use as an example, because in the original film, A New Hope, Luke Skywalker goes through a rite of passage, a process to become his destiny, what he's destined to be. And he has to sacrifice, and he has to toil and try, and he has to fail, and he has to learn through his failures and so on. But in this new one, the girl is just innately fantastic, and she doesn't really have to sacrifice, doesn't have to learn, doesn't have to toil, doesn't have to fail. She just is automatically great. Now that is so ridiculous and shallow and unrealistic and all this, but I think it kind of relates to, I think that men have to grow up in a way that women don't. I think that men generally, it's difficult to transition from being a boy to being a man. It's a very challenging transformation.
And it is, especially because most men don't have male role models to teach them how to do this.
Yeah, and the culture.
Millennial and Zoomer men, and even some Gen X men, were left completely adrift.
Yeah.
And they didn't even know they were supposed to be finding their own way.
No, they didn't.
And many of them don't realize it until it's too late. Many of them get to middle age before they realize that something went wrong.
Yeah. And I think that, but by contrast, I think that women, I mean, girls, yes, they become women, but I think it's almost something that happens just naturally. And it, as long as there's the correct cultural context for it to happen in, I don't think there are painful rites of passage that are necessary in order to transform a girl into a woman in the same way that there are that to transform a boy into a man. And so that it interests me about the Star Wars thing, because it's enacting this cliche where the woman doesn't, there is not a transformative process that needs to be undertaken for this woman. She just is innately, she her destiny. Whereas for the guy, there is.
Well, and putting a woman in that role in what is really kind of a mythopoeic hero's journey, and the hero's journey is, it's a masculine journey. This is also something I touch on in the Path of the Crone video that I've got up, is the difference between the man's hero's journey and what might be a woman's hero's journey. So to put a woman into that is, it is kind of a denial of her femininity, but you know, at the same time, it's also kind of like conditioning people to just accept that, condition men to accept that they're being replaced by women. They're becoming obsolete, you know? It's really no wonder that we've got so many, you know, angry incels, I guess you could say. And as a result, I actually don't think that women are becoming, you know, there isn't that transition from girl to woman. There's a transition from girl to pseudo man. And most women are very out of touch with their femininity, you know, and I talked about like the soy boys who are anima possessed. Women can be animus possessed. And this is, you know, your ball busting corporate bitch. It's the shrill harpy who has no relational skills, who's very argumentative, always has to be right. And, you know, we, at least probably, you know, from the 80s onward, maybe even a bit earlier, there really was a lack of female role models teaching girls how to become women, because our mothers worked. I mean, my mother worked. One year when I was probably in my late teens, early 20s, she got me a cookbook for Christmas. And I taught myself how to cook out of that because she hadn't been around to teach me to do it. And there are many, many women who have not had proper mothers, just in the way that men have not had proper fathers. And this is probably part of the root of this gender crisis is, you know, everything's kind of all mixed up now. Nobody knows what they're supposed to be. And we've got modern society telling us you can be anything you want to be, even if it's the other gender.
Well, I think it's true that they are going from being girls to being pseudo men. But I also think in a different way, they're going from being girls to being hyper girls, where the spoiled princess thing. But not women. That's the thing.
You know, yes, there's something always other than women, and it's such a degraded form of womanhood that it's almost unrecognizable as anything woman anymore. Is it any wonder that people now think that you can just identify as a woman, and that's the same thing? Because who even knows what a woman is anymore? Most women don't know what a woman is, and it's just become this kind of bizarro cult of vagina worship. You know, I've heard a lot of men complain about this, this dating site phenomenon where all of the women will only accept dates from the most attractive men, and then the rest of the men get nothing. I'm not really familiar with dating sites myself, but I've heard that this is a phenomenon, and that's, because women have been conditioned to be entitled princesses who think they're wonderful because they have a vagina. Newsflash, half the population of the world has one. You're not that special.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, that it's been a fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And there are so many things that could be picked up on. I think that we should probably do more streams of, and go into these things in more depth.
Yes. Well, we did talk about that at one point, so maybe we will at some stage.
Yes, I remember. Okay, so let's go to the super chats then, because there are, there are three. So, okay, someone says, fantastic discussion tonight. Merry Yule. Thank you. This is in appreciation for Millennial. Also, your guest is phenomenal.
Thank you.
And then someone else says, Woz, this is a very good guest. Kat, when do you continue the Evola series?
Ah, that is a good question. I am very close to having the script finished for the next episode. However, we are stepping it up a notch, and it is taking a little bit of extra time and has been delayed by just general holiday stresses and festivities. So hopefully we'll be getting it done at some point next month. But it is in the works. It will be continuing. We've been looking at releasing the first season on DVD to protect it from being memory hold, which a number of people have asked if we would do. So we'll look into what that would cost us to do. And I've also got, I still have to do the first season Q&A. I have a number of questions that people sent in about the first five episodes, just to address things in greater detail. So I'll hopefully have that up by mid-January, and then shortly thereafter, the next season will start. So we'll be kind of doing them, since there's 40 episodes, we'll be doing them in just like batches of five episodes a season, and then kind of taking a break to catch up, because we were releasing them every, basically once a month, and it's more time consuming than that to make an episode. So when we first started, we had about kind of three in our pocket that were close to being ready to release, and then we had to take a break to get caught up again. And part of the challenge with that is that being musicians, and perhaps this is a little bit self-indulgent, but we decided we wanted to include original songs with the episodes that kind of encapsulate the essence of that particular episode in a bite-size, catchy melody that will hopefully kind of be inspiring on its own.
Okay. Somebody asks, is there an order in which you would recommend reading Evola's works?
It kind of depends what you're interested in. Revolt is a very good place to start, just because it covers a lot of different topics in fairly short chapters, which you wouldn't know from the length of my episodes, but they're dense. So it can be kind of a good introduction to it. Otherwise, I would maybe suggest starting with Mystery of the Grail. If you're just completely new to Evola or any kind of metaphysical talk of any kind and esoteric symbolism, that can be a good one to start with, because it's a much narrower topic. I would definitely not recommend Ride the Tiger to people. It's one of the more difficult books and requires an extensive background knowledge of Nietzsche. But if you're well read on Nietzsche, that could be a good place to start, I guess. Those two, Revolt or Mystery of the Grail, would probably be my recommendations for an absolute beginner.
Okay. If there are any super chats or questions, please post them now. Somebody else asks, what kind of instruments are used in your music?
We use a lot of different instruments. So the first album, well, double album we released, Music for Nations, it's acoustic mainly. Kind of started out more neo-folk and ventured into some more, cinematic type stuff as we continued to build the album, with all the different people sort of bringing their influences into it. And the music that we're writing for the Revolt soundtrack is kind of more cinematic as well. So there's talk of a metal album in the future, but we're kind of we don't like to really lock ourselves into one specific genre. We do like to experiment with sound, so check it out. We do have, as I said, YouTube, Bandcamp. We're on all the major streaming services as well, so I think that's a more popular choice these days. Does anybody still buy CDs anymore? Used to be so fun going to the record store and picking out a CD, going home with it, looking through the booklet, and like, now there's no record stores and everybody just streams.
Yeah, I know. I was talking to somebody else about that just the other day, about how it's something that's been lost going into a record store, the experience of doing that and finding, treasures.
Yeah, it was an event. Mm. It was like, and you'd get so excited when you found something cool. You'd sit there and listen to your CD over and over until it got too scratched up to play anymore.
Yeah.
And now it's like, when's the last time anybody bought a CD? I mean, I used to buy a CD at least every month.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I did.
Oh, yeah. I think the last time, it must have been 10 years ago, I think. The last time
I
did.
So, yeah, we're on the streaming services for now anyway. And or if you prefer like a high quality, we have like Bandcamp downloads where you can download, like for the audio snobs who don't like compressed MP3s, you can download like Wave or FLAC.
Right. Okay. Somebody's saying vinyl is back. Perhaps you could look into that.
We have looked into that. The label's not too keen to do vinyl at this stage, from what I understand, but it's not completely off the table, I don't think.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Here's a sudden change to a much more serious topic. Ask Kat her thoughts on the social effects of high suicide rates among men and women between the ages of 40 and 60, and the young women's increasing dependence on medication for depression and anxiety.
Okay. Interesting. A bit out of left field. It's not a subject I've thought a lot about, so I'm kind of just talking off the cuff here. I would imagine that, what was the age group he said? Between 40 and 60?
60, yeah.
So kind of middle-aged, yeah. The social effects of that, I mean, I would imagine that a lot of those people have children that would be affecting. That's my first thought.
Yeah, I don't know if he means the social reasons for that happening or the social effects off it happening.
Well, he does mention the women taking antidepressants. I know it's a very high percentage. It might even be as high as like 1 in 4 or something, but at least 10% of the population has taken them in the last month or something like that. The statistics are very high and ever increasing. And it wouldn't surprise me if that coincides with suicide rates, given that increased suicidal thoughts are a side effect of a lot of those drugs. And they really, I'll just like say, I personally am totally against psychotropic drugs like that. They mess up your brain. You're basically giving yourself a chemical lobotomy. They're incredibly difficult to come off of. They have terrible side effects. If you're on something like that to deal with your feelings, you're not really developing healthy coping mechanisms to deal with real life. And that to me suggests that there's a lot of people who can't cope with life raw anymore. Like the normal vicissitudes of life are like, there's so much for people that they need a pill. A lot of what people are getting treated for is not depression. It's just like normal feelings of sadness, frustration, nihilism. And they're taking a pill to try to make themselves feel better rather than changing their situation, or more importantly, changing their internal orientation. Because what I have found in my experience is that a lot of people who struggle with that kind of negative thinking do so because they haven't learned how to change their own thought patterns. They're kind of at the mercy of their own parasitic mind. They can't stop the negative thoughts. They can't stop focusing on the negativity. And taking a pill does not fix that.
I will counter signal you just on the matter of, because in my own experience, I had a long time ago, 11 years ago, I had an episode where I was, I've talked about it in a few of my earlier videos, and it's difficult to describe it now off the cuff, but basically I went into a very high stress situation where I was sort of pseudo manic for about 3 weeks because something, it was a trauma that happened. And I got onto anti-anxiety pills, Effexor XL, which I think is then Lafaxine. And that was a godsend for me. And they are also called antidepressants. And weirdly, anxiety and depression are linked, or at least are treated by often common drugs. And that was a fantastic thing for me. And weirdly, there were not even any side effects, really. So I'm really glad that I got into Effexor XL. But that was only, I was only on them, well, first of all, it was a crisis. And it wasn't just, oh, I'm miserable, I'm sad, I'm disappointed. It was a crisis, sort of short-term thing. And second, I was only on them for a few months. I think I was on them for, I don't know, something like 4 months, maybe 6 months. And but they were never supposed to be a solution to my life. They were just a life raft for that time to calm me the fuck down. To calm down, because I really needed that. But no, I would never say to someone, antidepressants will solve your problem. Because they simply won't.
Well, in the long term, they do cause more problems. But there's a difference between taking them very short term for a specific reason and taking them long term because you cannot develop healthy coping strategies for your life. And, you know, in our society, we're just kind of taught everything should be instant gratification. You go to the doctor, all they know how to do is prescribe pills or surgery. They don't know how to treat, you know, the root cause of anything. Most psychologists are not very good at their jobs. And so you end up with people who probably feel like they don't really have any other recourse than to take these pills and to take them for a very long period of time. I notice on like leftist Twitter, you often have like these feminists and soy boy types who are like, I need my antidepressants. Oh, and it's like, but you don't seem happy.
Yeah, and it's so telling. For you? Exactly. It's so telling that it's these people who, you know, are, again, you know, is it a good sign that you're talking about how we can build this great society, but you yourself are a mess. But then it's not just isolated to the left, is it? You know, we've got to be, what we've been talking about throughout a large part of this talk is that there are a lot of damaged people on the right as well.
Well, and a lot of depressed people, and not without good reason, because once you come to the right, it's because you've often realized how terrible the modern world is. There's a lot to be depressed about. I'm not judging anybody for being depressed about the modern world. I get depressed about the modern world. But
so somebody's just, it seems like everyone in Scotland is on antidepressants.
Yes.
Not quite everyone, but sorry to interrupt you, Kat.
That's all right. My phone buzzed and that distracted me there for a second too. I just put it on silent. Yes, it's when you have people who are, you know, feeling depressed about situations they can't change. And I think a lot of times that is where it comes from, is feeling powerless to change your situation. And in many cases, that's because the person has this external locus of control. And that tends to be a function of the fact that they don't have a lot of internal control. And people who struggle to control themselves often then compensate by trying to control things outside of themselves, by controlling the people around them, their environment. They get very angry and frustrated when things don't go their way. And this is a recipe for feeling miserable. It is a lot of work to change things inside yourself. It's difficult to kind of build up your inner strength such that you can weather any storm that comes. And we have, you know, these modern people who are just so very weak in the face of any adversity that they just crumble. And then they think that that's depression. And I'm not negating, I'm not invalidating anybody's feelings. I'm sure that they legitimately are suffering and in real pain. But the solution is not drugs. The solution is not endless psychoanalysis. And I mean, I don't normally talk about any kind of like personal stuff, but I will say that I struggled for a long time with, you know, depression when I was younger. And over time, I have come to learn that this was really just a product of my own mind. There were times when my life was pretty much objectively perfect on paper, and I was still unhappy. And there have been times when, you know, now that I'm older, there have been some really hard times where I've been able to maintain a much more upbeat and optimistic attitude in the face of it. And it's because I've worked hard to change my internal nature. And one thing that's really helped me with that is I've spoken to you about this privately a few times is meditation. And I always recommend that to anybody who is struggling with depression, because that is a great way to come to know yourself and reflect and kind of get comfortable with your emotions and learn how to let them not affect you. This idea of sitting with a feeling, but being detached from it, or I should say maybe not detached, but non-attached, and understanding that it is temporary, it will pass, and you won't feel like this forever, and just waiting it out.
Absolutely. Somebody else points out, antidepressants did not work for me. The only way out of long-term depression is proactive change. Now, that kind of contradicts what you just said, that nothing lasts forever. It does pass. That's true. But it's also true that the only way to really beat it and stop it from coming back again is to proactive change.
Well, I don't disagree with that at all. And sometimes that proactive change comes from changing your external circumstances. Maybe you're in a terrible living situation and you really would just genuinely be happier if you could move, and you move and then you're fine. However, the real change needs to come from within. And when the real change comes from within, you will be okay even in a bad situation. It might be unpleasant. You might be quite miserable, but you can remain somewhat stoic in the face of it and not let it affect your internal equilibrium, if that makes sense.
Definitely. Somebody points out the education system and the social services and so on view boys as defective girls. Now, this is a statement that's been made. I've heard it quite a lot for the last 10 years or so. What would you say about this?
Absolutely. This expectation that boys should just be sitting still and share their feelings and be interested in crafts and things. It's so silly. I've worked with boys a lot, especially like school-aged boys. And most of them don't really thrive in the kind of like modern classroom setting. And so much of the modern curriculum seems to be not anything interesting to boys, like, you know, math and science or even history or anything. And the way they teach that is just so boring. Nobody's going to be interested in that, but I'm sure that that's part of why they want it to be boring, is so that kids don't actually go looking into history for themselves. In the 90s, there was like this tendency to want to medicate every boy for like ADHD. I don't know if you remember that. And it's like every kid was getting an ADHD diagnosis and being told they had to be medicated to go to school. And it just turned them into zombies. God knows what the long-term effects were on their brains with that. It's horrifying.
I think it was Ritalin.
Yep. That was the main one. Yes, Adderall and some of the others. But they're basically amphetamines. They're giving pretty hard drugs to children whose brains are still developing just because we need to have like a girl-centered curriculum or whatever.
That's actually an interesting question to end with. What would you say a boy, because you've said boys are not defective girls. Obviously, we can take that for granted. But what would a boy-centered curriculum be like?
Well, that is actually something that I worked on developing a little bit myself with one of the children that I worked with, who was a year younger than his classmates, and he was, you know, starting to struggle a little bit. He'd started school not speaking English anyway, so he was already behind. And so a lot of my role with him was getting him caught up and, you know, developing ways that would help him learn better. And I mean, Girls are great, but I love little boys. Their energy and their enthusiasm is so wonderful, and they love to learn. If you've got a boy in school who doesn't love learning, it's because you're a terrible teacher and your classroom sucks. If you get a boy excited about something, they fixate on it. It's like, you know, it's almost autistic in a way. Like, autism is kind of like extreme male brain in some way. So every boy has this in him a little bit. You just have to find out what he's passionate about. And this little boy decided that he loved weapons. We discovered this on a rainy day, making crossbows out of office supplies. And 4 years later, he ended up building a 60-pound crossbow out of supplies from the hardware store, which actually worked and was probably quite a deadly weapon. And we structured a lot of his learning around his fascination with weapons, including an entire summer curriculum I designed for him around the Punic Wars of ancient Rome. And he had never loved history before then, but once this kid was spending his days drawing diagrams of like the triremes and all the other ships they were using, and looking up information online about their weapons, and he was so excited about it. And I would not even say that that's a boy-centered curriculum as such. The interest, of course, is very male. But I find with any child, the key is to find out what they're passionate about, because the more passionate they are in learning, the more they will commit to it. It is impossible to teach a child something they don't want to learn. I used to tutor German, and if you get a kid who doesn't want to learn, they're just not going to practice, and they will end the year speaking German only marginally better than they did when you started with them 9 months before. It doesn't matter how many hours you put in. Their brains won't retain it. And especially with children, they learn so much through play and interacting with their world. So, you know, that's where like the building of weapons came in handy, because it was something he could actually do with his hands. And he was quite the little engineer, really brilliant kid. You would be like, how is this kid struggling in school? Probably one of the smartest kids I knew. And he would make the most amazing Lego contraptions. I was not allowed to touch his Legos because he said my Lego car was terrible. It was like a block on wheels. And he said it was an embarrassment and I shouldn't touch Legos anymore. But you know, he did really well once we found out what he was interested in. And that's been my experience with all children, is that once they're interested in something, they tend to just really latch onto it and they don't let it go.
Yeah, I would say, I completely agree. But what I would say is I do think that obsessiveness is, I think that men are more obsessive than women. I think that boys are more obsessive than girls. And so that's going to be a much more powerful battery to get him engaged in something. You know, if it's a boy, he's going to have it. Like, I remember the first things that it's embarrassing now, but the first thing that I was obsessed with was Doctor Who when I was 5 years old. And then I wanted to know absolutely everything about Doctor Who. And I think in the 2 years that followed that, because it stopped when I was seven because of domestic reasons, but for the 2 years that followed that, I was just obsessed. And then after that, there were other things. And I went, my childhood was a sort of succession of obsessions from the age of five onwards. And really, I drove my parents mad because of the power of it. And so,
yes, you know, every of boys knows this is true.
Well, and if my education had been built around that, I would have learned a hell of a lot more, I'm sure of it. But yes. The way it was so sort of slow-paced, perfunctory, and boring that I wasn't engaged at all at high school. Primary school, I was like,
it's impossible to create something around a child's passions in a classroom of 30 kids who all like different things. This is one of the reasons I'm a big proponent of homeschooling. I mean, there are some kids who do really well in a classroom setting, but a lot of them don't. And if you can homeschool, that allows your child to pursue their passions to a high degree. But it does require a fair commitment from the parent, because you need to be pretty interested in what they're interested in so that you can build around what it is that they want to learn. if you've got a kid who is obsessed with Doctor Who and you don't know anything about Doctor Who, it's pretty hard to design a curriculum around it in ways that draw all these different subject matters into this one coherent theme of Doctor Who.
But they're very straightforward at the end of it. But The point I was making was simply that I can see why, if you can connect the learning with something that he is interested in, obsessed with, engaged in, or whatever, he's going to immediately find reasons why he should learn this stuff. He's going to generate the motivation himself.
Yes, and you know, that's another thing with homeschooling. A lot of parents, I think, are intimidated by the idea of how much time they have to put into it. But when you have a child who's a motivated learner, they are largely self-taught by a certain point. And you shouldn't have to do too much other than check their work and make sure they're learning what they need to learn. Especially by the time they reach high school, they should know where to go to find information. And I think a lot of this fear is the function of people who have never learned anything for themselves. When I hear people say, oh, I could never homeschool my kid because I'm not a teacher. And it's like, well, when was the last time you tried to teach yourself something? And the answer is often never. So they think that in order to learn something, they have to have it spoon fed to them by an authority of some kind. And it's like, for myself, most of the best things that I've learned were not in a classroom, but things that I was just interested in. And I just, you know, this is my honorary man status talking, got a little obsessed with it and just like would go down a rabbit hole and learn everything I could about it.
Yeah, I can believe it. All right. Well, look, let's end it there because this has been really interesting, but I am exhausted. This is the fourth of the fourth one tonight. So I'm sure I know we could go on longer, and the chat's a bit more upbeat now that we're not moaning about men so much. Understandable. But
And hey, guys, I like men. I'm here talking to one right now. I like him.
Yeah.
Probably would like all of you.
Yeah, earlier on, it was a wee bit unfortunate because I could see why some guys would be annoyed, but at the same time, it was a discussion worth having, and I don't see anything. It was perfectly fine. But yeah, it's nice to end on a more positive note. So one final question. So a guy asks, what about Evola's East and West? I have that sitting on my bookshelf. Would that be a good start?
I actually have not read that one. I've read a few excerpts from it, but I don't know enough about it to say whether or not it would be a good one to start. But look, if that's what you've got on your shelf, give it a try. You know, if you find that you're not understanding it, you can put it back and come back to it after you've read some other stuff, maybe.
Okay.
I will say, I'll preface that by saying the first Evola book that I read was one of his most challenging ones, and I did manage to get through it okay. So if you really put your mind to it, you can get through it even if it's hard.
Yes. All right. One person says, hail woes, hail cat. For cat, what sort of metal would you invest in playing in the future?
I have no idea. It's not something I follow at all. I have zero interest in money beyond what I need to keep a roof over my head.
No, I think he meant what sort of metal would you, like music, metal, the genre.
He said invest in?
Invest in playing in the future.
I assumed he meant like invest in, like, you know, gold and silver and whether or not they would.
He said playing in the future.
Well, I guess I can answer both. Not sure what kind of metal it would be. With the introduction of me to the band as a classically trained singer, it would probably be more along the lines of some kind of symphonic metal with some cinematic elements, because we are really enjoying those and playing with those. But yeah, that's something we would have to think about, and we're not really we haven't really gotten that far ahead in our planning in regards to any metal album.
Okay. And then on the other question.
So hopefully whichever he meant, it answered it.
Okay. So someone's suggesting silver apparently is the one to get into. Anyway, okay. Let's leave it at that then. So that was a really interesting discussion and quite controversial. I think I banned about 10 people. Yeah, it's pretty bad. I don't like doing it, but they were just being not constructive, not helpful. So, okay, right, we'll leave it there. Philosophicat.
You got it.
Yeah. Oh, someone said, I bought every Tom Baker and Pertwee DVD on Doctor Who. Yes, yes. Very good, good errors there. Okay, so Philosophicat. Thank you for taking part in Millennial 2019. Everyone who's been watching, thank you. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back tomorrow with, hold on, The Golden One, Zurius Semiogog, and J.F. Garipi.
Nice so, lineup.
Yeah, that's another star lineup for tomorrow night. So, okay. Thank you very much, and thank you, Philosophicat, and I will see you all tomorrow night.